Chapter 9 Team of Champions. I woke up hours later than I meant to. A small black cat is curled up against my head, weighing down my hair. Her purr is deafening. But what pulls me out of a deep and dreamless sleep is the indescribable sensation of having my eyebrows licked. Ugh! I growl. Spooky chirrups in satisfaction and walks across the pillow, pulling my hair painfully, then applying her surprisingly heavy paws to various parts of my anatomy through the duvet. She migrates to my belly, sits down, and starts to massage my bladder. Ow! Okay, I get the message. I sit up, grab her behind her shoulders, and pour her onto the floor. Then I go to the bathroom. When I get back, she's washing herself with evident unconcern, right in the middle of the bed, clearly determined to wake me up. Typical. I rattle the wardrobe door for a minute before I remember giving the key to Bob. Bob? I call. There's no reply. So I stumble downstairs and peer round the living room door. The spare duvet is neatly folded on the sofa, with a white envelope sitting neatly on top of it, like a cherry on a pudding. I pick it up, and the key falls out. So does a sheet of paper. Dear Mo, had to leave early to get the train. You're right, but I don't like it. We'll try to figure out how to rob a bank without breaking the law. Love, Bob. I sigh. Bob, you incurable fool. No, he doesn't like it. Neither do I. But I went through a divorce once before, some years before I met him. Neither of us want it to happen. But that doesn't mean it's not going to. Yesterday I thought it was just a matter of finding someone else to carry Lecter. Now, it looks infinitely bleaker. I go upstairs and unlock the wardrobe, pull out the violin case, and sort out a work outfit. Slacks, top, regular jacket. Then I pick out a severe suit and blouse, suitable for emergency meetings with ministers, and fold them into an old carry-on bag. It can go live in the office. I'm not planning on dressing like an undertaker every day, just on the off chance that I will come to the attention of important people. I glance down as Spooky weaves between my legs, tail high, eyes big and pleading. Oh, you. I take my kit back down to the kitchen, then hunt around until I figure out what Bob's been feeding her. I top up her bowl and then, this is icky, look in the cellar. Oh dear. Well, at least Bob cleaned the litter tray before he left. Spooky follows me in, and seeing a pristine field determines that this cannot be. I turn my back and flee while she goes about her business. I see from the kitchen clock that it's nearly 10 o'clock. I swear softly. Bob must have left an hour or two ago. Dismay sweeps across me like a frontal weather system, deepening and darkening as it comes. This is silly. We have phones, don't we? Suddenly, the kitchen feels claustrophobic and stifling. Everything in here reminds me of our life together, piling weight atop the feeling that we're sliding out of control towards the edge of a cliff. I've lived with Bob for half my adult life, nearly a quarter of my entire existence. I can't stand this, I realize. I set up the cafetiere with shaking hands, boil the kettle, and carefully make myself a coffee. I pull my laptop out and plug it in to check my email. Then find I can't read the subject lines because my eyes are watering all the time. I ache, physically and mentally. When I pull myself together and finish snivelling, I wipe my eyes and try again. The first message is from the SA. Good grief, it reads. What did you tell them at the Home Office briefing? Homesick reported to have said it's the funniest thing she's seen since the remake of Yes Minister. P.S. Scuttlebutt is that they're taking your pitch seriously. Budget likely to be approved, subject to enhanced performance metrics and a 10% haircut. I blink with surprise. No plan survives contact with the enemy, so I'd assumed they'd approve a fraction of what I was pitching for. To get 90% is unexpected, to say the least. It is against my personal policy to answer any email message short of a declaration of war within an hour of waking up or before finishing my morning coffee. So I don't reply, but move on to the next. And the next. I'm just about certain it's all trivia when I run across a missive from Internal Security. With regard to your inquiry about Chief Superintendent James Gray, I can confirm that he has cleared background checks and has signed Section 3. Chief Superintendent Gray is an approved liaison officer for laundry operations requiring a command level or lower London Metropolitan Police contact. Chief Superintendent Gray reports to Deputy Assistant Commissioner Smedley of the Metropolitan Police Service, is assigned to the Special Operations Directorate, led by Assistant Commissioner Stanwyck, and is currently on semi-permanent secondment to ACPO. He is an approved liaison officer for laundry operations requiring a command level or lower contact to coordinate with any territorial or special police force. So Jim is on the up and up. I speed read the rest of the detailed reply. Then I double check my assumptions and go look for a description of a chief super's role and responsibilities. He's one step below chief officer rank. That makes him the equivalent of an army colonel. The secondment to ACPO. Think in terms of a colonel working for the general staff of an army. He's clearly riding the up escalator. In other words, he's a high flyer. Which in turn means that he's quite possibly more ambitious than Mary. Now that's a scary thought. I file it away for later, while I check the rest of my inbox, which is overflowing with mundanity. Mary has, of course, sent over a full list of the confirmed missing manuscripts. Following a hunch, I double-check, and yes, the score to an unperformed operetta of The King in Yellow is on the list, along with an index number in the Danzy House stacks. I keep on reading. Something about the business at the British Library is nagging at me. Something that feels wrong, even in the context of a mad scientist with a horror music obsession. But it doesn't quite gel. So I lose myself in the pile of routine correspondence. Nothing else demands my immediate attention until I get to a missive from Mary, time-stamped half an hour ago.
Help! HR are threatening to send us a liaison from...
redacted by firewall filter.
I don't know what to do.
A what? Damn. This calls for a reply. She's clearly in a tizzy, and anything coming out of HR that is capable of wrong-footing my bureaucratic tightrope-walking MBA vampire is definite cause for concern. Especially as Emma told me to expect a second wave of staff to show up this week. I fire back. Hold the fort. I'll be in by noon. P.S. The firewall ate your key facts. I finish my coffee, descend into the cellar and hold my nose while I wield the slotted poop of shame on behalf of Spooky. Then I pack my bags and head for the office. I arrive around 11:30 and climb the stairs, cursing my aching knees, not to mention last night's intimate aches and strains. Sarah is busy with the equipment rack behind the front desk. She nods as I go past. The analysts, Sam and Nick, are at their desks, but they look as if they only just got there. I give them what I hope is a sufficiently knowing smile as I walk by. I dump my violin and the overnight bag in the corner of my office, and I'm just about to head next door when Mary pops her head round the corner. I manage not to hiss and jump backwards as she recoils dramatically into the corridor.
What is it?
I ask.
The windows.
Oh, wait one. I dive back across my office and pull down the Venetian blinds. That better?
Yes, thank you,
she says, sounding slightly shaken, as she sidles into the room. She's back to her anti-sunlight war paint, but less of it this morning. She's probably afraid it's insufficient to avoid sunburn. She's also dialed back on the office formal wear a notch.
It's that HR thing, I'm afraid. I don't know what to do about...
Wait. I offer her the visitor's chair. You'll need to explain it all over again. The firewall ate the middle of your message.
The firewall what?
It almost comes out in a wail. She grabs the armrests and digs her fingers in.
You didn't get it?
Get what?
Emma's trying to be helpful.
Mary bursts out.
What's wrong with...
Oh. Yes. That could be a problem if she makes a habit of it. I'll have to dissuade her discreetly. I pause. So, she's sending us some kind of liaison person? Is it Jim Gray? Mary looks at me blankly.
Now, who?
Officer Friendly, in his real-life disguise as a senior cop from ACPO. Okay, so it's not him. He's on the list, though. I expect him to be parachuted in just to keep an eye on what we're up to, and there are no grounds to keep him out. Who...
A deep one,
she bursts out. My stomach flip-flops.
Tell me this isn't who I think it is.
I nod at Mary encouragingly, hoping my pallid smile doesn't look too sickeningly stunned. She takes a deep breath.
They're actively liaising with surface dwellers, according to Emma. It's all terribly new, since last month, but they say they want to help us and lend us resources for dealing with the random superpower problem. Emma says we can't afford not to take what's on offer for fear of offending the Blue Hades, so it looks like whether we like it or not, we're going to get lumbered with this fish fucker. Ms. Murphy!
I snap, suddenly angry.
What?
She looks at me wide-eyed. May I remind you of the existence of our diversity and discrimination policies? I ask, trying to keep my voice sweet. The self-same policies you had cause to remind me of last Thursday, and of our duties under the Disability Discrimination Act 2010.
Ooh.
She purses her lips, astonished, then leans back in her chair, relaxing in a thoughtful pose.
Yes, you're right, and I'm wrong. Sorry. Won't happen again.
She nods.
You're the boss.
I somehow manage to keep a straight face. Is this liaison from Blue Hades by any chance? My desk phone rings. Sorry, got to answer. I pick up the call while Mary waits. Hello?
Mom?
It's the security guard on reception.
There's a lady here who says Emma McDougall in HR sent her, but she doesn't have a warrant card, and her ID smells of seaweed.
I roll my eyes at Mary. She nods, expression grim. Fang supersenses for the win. There's no need for a speakerphone when my deputy can hear a pin drop at 500 metres.
Is she in a wheelchair?
I ask. And what's her name?
Yes. How did you know about the chair? She, I know this sounds odd, but she says she's called Ramona Random. Does that...
Oh, yes, send her right up. I've been expecting her. I say, trying to keep a straight face as I savour Mary's surprise. Then I put the phone down. This is a setup, I tell her, keeping my tone even. Someone upstairs from Emma is deliberately stacking the management deck so unsubtly they don't care if I know. I'm going to make it my business to find out why, but first, we've got to find her a desk.
Why? Who is she?
Well, I never. But of course. Mary left before Bob got sent to St. Martin on that joint operation with the Black Chamber, didn't she? Let's just say she's a friend of Bob's. I am not blind to the way she twitches microscopically at any mention of my husband's name. I stand up. Come on, it's time for you to meet your first mermaid. The next few days go as smoothly as can be expected. Let me summarise rapidly so we can get to the next significant happening. I briefed Mary about Ramona on our way to reception. I couldn't resist explaining the business on St. Martin. I told her all about Ramona's destiny entanglement with Bob and her regrettable dietary needs while she was under the thumb of the Black Chamber. It was cruel of me, but really fucking amusing. Ahem. For her part, Ramona arrives by elevator, because that's how she rolls these days. She rides in a motorized wheelchair, using a rug or a long skirt to hide her deformed lower limbs. Her glamour is more effective by far than my makeup or Mary's fang-enhanced appearance, but she makes up for it by being disarmingly friendly and charming as well as supernaturally pretty. At first, Mary circles her, like a suspicious cat, tail raised and bristling, unsure whether to attack or roll over. But Ramona can deal with Mary in her sleep. I put Ramona in charge of human resources, with a remit to ride herd on Emma McDougall's more madcap misapprehensions about the personnel requirements of the Transhuman Policy Coordination Unit. It works swimmingly. And by Thursday, M and R are practically joined at the hip, drawing up a skills matrix for evaluating the core competencies of candidates for the Embryonic Transhuman Law Enforcement Assistance Force. Footnote. We're British, damn it. We have an ISO standard national sense of humour. Some job's worth will doubtless change the organisation's title when it goes before a Home Office subcommittee for approval, but in the meantime, we brew up strong. On Friday, I come in to find them preparing briefings for freelance comic scriptwriters to help us to flesh out the image of the Home Office super team in the public eye. And I mentally pat myself on the back. Teamwork, we have it. Once I've given my statements and written up all the reports arising from the British Library business, it's back to the real job, with people and processes covered. I'm free to focus on long-range policy and work out how to bluff my way through the executive vision thing, which is as it should be. I steal an hour a day to go down to the basement storeroom, hang out a Do Not Disturb sign, lock the door securely, and tune up my violin. Practice? We need it. Initially, Lecter sulks. He's baffled and frustrated by my failure to feed him my husband's soul, and resentful at my recent neglect of his needs. At first, his timber is lifeless and rough, but the exigencies of practice slowly reach him, and after an hour or so, the old magic flows. So does blood from the ears of the security guard when he hears something and comes to listen through the door. So on subsequent practices, I not only lock the basement storeroom, but have his replacement wedge the fire door giving access to the basement stairwell shut. I'm much less likely to die in a fire down there than I am to suck the soul from an unwitting intruder. As for the guard, I make sure to send him a card in hospital. I work late most evenings, doing my reading and writing up reports to a background of BBC Radio 3 or Classic FM on a portable radio I brought into my office. It's my one guilty pleasure. I turn it on only after everyone else has left. When I go home, I sleep in my own bed. There are no recurrences of the horrid dancing dreams, much less of sight-reading the score from Casilda's song. I don't even know if it's a real part of the missing score. Mary's probing determines that the BL held the only known copy of The King in Yellow, which has never had an actual no-shit performance in public, and was written in the 1920s by an over-impressionable disciple of Schoenberg's, Austin Osman Speer, who ended up in Broadmoor Hospital. Spooky takes to waking me in the morning by wrapping herself, purring, around my head. She sleeps cuddled up against my side and sits in my lap when I check my email on the sofa after dinner. This would be wonderfully endearing if she wasn't also prone to waking up howling in the middle of the night and running lengths of the house. She also stalks my toes if I accidentally stick them out from under the duvet, and yells at me when the litter tray isn't cleaned to her scrupulous standards. Endearing my ass. Bob emails me once a day from a secure terminal. I email him back. Sweet nothings, miss you, wish you were here. We kick the can down the road. I can't be sure, but I'm very much afraid it's a highway, destination signposted to nowhere. On Wednesday morning, I get dragged over to the Home Office for a much less intimidating meeting, chaired by an undersecretary and a staff. They go over my strategy proposal point by point, ironing out any ambiguities and nailing down assumptions. We spend a couple of hours on it and part amicably. I go over to the new annex, which is now mostly up and running again, and attend the weekly special projects briefing. Spec Proj is a security-cleared meet and greet, intended to secure that everyone with a stake in one or another of our R&D streams is at least vaguely aware of what else is going on. At least about the stuff they're cleared for that they might need to use. We hear a report from the subcommittee on occult artifacts, such as Lecter, also a report on capabilities and threat postures presented by foreign government Occident agencies, a backgrounder on the latest updates to the Benthic treaties, as signed by the various ambassadors last Friday, although they've been in the works for years. And finally, a presentation on the population dynamics of superpower distribution.
The growth curve is showing signs of slackening as of last week, says the earnest young man from epidemiology. It's still too early to be sure. The error bars are quite wide, but we are reasonably optimistic that by this time next month, we'll be able to plot a curve and see where things are going to within a 5% confidence interval. We're also refining the power distribution curve, stripping out the hard stats. If the growth curve is the sigmoid we think we're looking at, then when it levels off, about one person per million in the general population will have high-level superpowers, 5 sigma stuff. The main body of the normal distribution, 1 sigma either side of the norm, is 1 in 1,000, and we can't detect anything more than a single sigma to the left of the median.
There are some dismayed noises when the audience realizes the implication. 60,000 people in the UK can expect to receive normal levels of superpowers. But he goes on to pour reassuringly cold water on their fears.
Normal 1 sigma powers aren't much to worry about. We're talking about powers like the unerring ability to stand on a tube platform right where the doors of the train will open every time. Or to call pigeons. That's single sigma stuff. It's nothing you can't match with careful training or a bag of stale breadcrumbs. In fact, half the people in this room are practitioners with powers equal to or exceeding a 3 sigma superhero or supervillain, if you have the advance notice and equipment to set it up.
I raise my hand. Tell me about the 4 and 5 sigmas.
I can't.
He's blunt, but looks apologetic.
The 4 sigmas are typically stronger than a locomotive and faster than a speeding bullet, until air friction burns their face off. There's a wide range of abilities, often stacked in multiples. Stripjack Sprat,
I wince,
was probably a 3 to 4 sigma super wacko. A 4 sigma is probably able to equal the capabilities of a DSS if they had the training and self-discipline.
A DSS is a detached special secretary, in laundry speak, unofficially a deeply scary sorcerer. Mahogany Row members are all at that level or above. But most of the laundry doesn't know or isn't cleared for or doesn't understand Mahogany Row.
A 5 sigma would be something we haven't met yet, and a walking disaster if they turn out to be malevolent. We're talking superheroes or supervillains out of Marvel or DC comics here. Super fast, super strong, pretty much invincible. If they turned out bad, our only hope would be to outwit them or rely on superior logistics and organisational capabilities to wear them down.
I raise my hand again. People are beginning to look at me oddly. What about Officer Friendly? Or Professor Freudstein? Our tame epidemiologist frowns.
Officer Friendly is probably a 3 to 4 sigma case. Super strength, flight, night vision. Plus there's that armour of his. He has to have a tech support backup. Possibly a 4 sigma tinker. Or maybe it's outsourced to BAE systems.
I've been asking myself questions. Like, Officer Friendly flies around wearing blue body armour, complete with a piece of protective headgear modelled on the classic British Bobby's custodian helmet, with a flashing beacon light on top. So who made it for him?
I could venture some speculations, but I'd rather not, He only seems to turn up when the police need him. Let's leave it at that.
And Freudstein? I repeat.
Professor.
He glances round the room.
At first glance, he looks like a Five Sigma superintelligence, but there's something about it that smells funny. I have some ideas, but nothing concrete,
he says abruptly.
See me later.
But I don't get a chance to do that. Dr. Michael Armstrong, the senior auditor, has an office in the new annex. And on Wednesday after my home office meeting, I visit him in his office. If you walk the length of the plushly carpeted corridor called Mahogany Row, you may or may not notice a discreetly panelled door. It depends on whether or not its occupant wants you to see it. The office behind it overflows the bounding box described by the architectural plans for the new annex. It's about 5 metres longer and 2 metres wider than it can be and still fit within the walls. Also, it's on the fourth floor, but I am told the window looks out on a vista from ground level. As you can imagine, some people find that sort of thing disturbing.
Come in, Mo,
he says surprisingly informally.
Make yourself at home.
I would think his den was invitingly collegiate if I didn't know exactly what he does for a living. The SA was, until a week ago, Angleton's supervisor. His hall monitor, sanity check, what have you. The SA isn't himself an unhuman entity like the Eater of Souls, but you don't put someone in charge of Angleton unless they have the power to bind and release demons from the depths of the dungeon dimensions and more besides. 2 decades ago, Dr. Armstrong was one of the most powerful members of the Invisible College, as Mahogany Row is sometimes still known by the oldest of old-timers. Today, he largely works in a supervisory role. They relied too much on ritual magic back in the day. Krantzberg syndrome was an ever-present risk. So they thought it best to retire at the peak of their abilities, to a position where their experience and their insight into the temptations and corruptions a practitioner can fall victim to was still of use to the organisation. He's still an extremely powerful sorcerer. It's just that if he makes much use of his skills, he stands to lose them in the most unpleasant manner imaginable. As I enter his office, I look around. The interior is dominated by floor-to-ceiling bookcases on 3 sides. One wall is interrupted by an archaic cast-iron radiator set beneath a sash window, the view through which is concealed by curtains. As it's the outer wall of his office, but the inner wall is barely inside the building, I am not terribly keen to see the landscape it opens onto. Michael's desk is pretty much what you'd expect, although most of its top is covered by a beautiful Victorian escritoire, a leather-topped writing slope. The other half supports an ancient green-screen computer terminal, the variety that uses a cathode ray tube to display wavering little mono-spaced characters and can't do graphics at all. Angleton might have disapproved, but I find the essay's reliance on such intermediate technology rather charming, like a penchant for 1970s sports cars or a complete collection of Grateful Dead bootlegs. You wanted to talk to me?
Yes. I wanted to talk to you.
His silence is thoughtful. He gestures at a battered-looking sofa next to the window. As I walk over to it, he drags his office chair out from behind his desk. It's an antique banker swivel chair, an oak and leather forerunner to the Herman Miller monstrosity in my own office, and sits down in it so that the desk doesn't separate us. The sofa tries to swallow me. Escape may be difficult.
You shut down the inquiry rather fast. Yes, I did.
His pensive stare is directed at a bookshelf about a metre to the right of my shoulder, for which I am grateful. Why? I ask bluntly. Is the Audit Commission compromised? After a disturbingly long pause, he replied.
I don't think so.
Oh dear. Oh dear. Oh dear.
Then what? Tell me about your suspicions,
He smiles. It's the avuncular smile of an executioner shaking his client's hand and reassuring him that this won't hurt at all. I swallow. I trust Emma McDougall implicitly. I see. But her staff selections are a little bit too selective for it to be a coincidence, don't you think?
Which selections?
He raises an eyebrow.
No, wait. You look a little fraught. You have no more meetings scheduled until after lunchtime.
I'm not sure how he knows that. The only thing in this office that's capable of talking to the departmental calendar server is my phone.
Let me offer you an aperitif. And a little something else.
He reaches around the side of his desk and opens a drawer from which he takes two cut glass tumblers and a dark green bottle. I stare at the bottle. Organization policy on drinking in the workplace says,
I predate it, and I outrank it. I do not propose to get you drunk, merely slightly relaxed, with a lunch break in which to recover your composure before you return to your office.
But what if... I begin to frame another objection.
Dr. O'Brien.
There is a steely glint in his eye as he breaks the seal on a bottle of single malt that is not only older than I am, but probably costs more than I earn in a week.
This organization trusts you to carry a certain violin.
I instinctively reach for the case that sits at my feet.
As for me, I spent 6 years with that instrument singing to me in my dreams. You are still alive. I believe that you have demonstrated sufficient willpower that you can withstand a single measure of the water of life.
He hands me a tumbler. I accept it in stunned silence and inhale the nose. The whiskey is amazing, smoky, peaty, with a lingering, slightly sweet afternote. I hold it until he raises his glass in a toast.
To your success.
My what?
You've carried him. I used to call him Dracula. For the third longest time that anybody has managed. In fact, you're a week away from making it into second place. That's very impressive, Doctor. But it can't go on forever.
It can't? I sip the whiskey.
Of course not, but I mean,
you carried him?
Yes, for a number of years before he passed into your hands.
Dr. Armstrong examines me coolly. He reaches into his desk drawer and pulls out a small packet.
I think you should take this. You can use it to call on me at any time if you think you can't cope anymore. Hopefully, it's an unnecessary precaution, just in case. There was a gap between I and my successor, you know. I'm afraid I could only handle him for 6 years and 2 months before he hospitalized me.
He takes another sip. I notice that the skin on the backs of his hands is wrinkled with age and liver-spotted. They are shaking slightly. And I realize that not once has he looked directly at Lecter's case. I open the packet and shake a silver chain and a small bangle into my hand.
What happened?
I ask, running the chain through my fingers.
That's a story for another time,
he says.
For now, just hang on to that. When you can't bear it anymore, call me, and I'll come. But that's not why I invited you here today. What I really want is for you to tell me about your suspicions. What do you think is wrong?
I take a deep breath and try to relax. It's the wrong move. I shudder, transfixed by a sudden irrational fear that we're being listened in on by Mary. It's the staff assignments coming from HR. I take a mouthful of raw spirit, disrespectfully fast, choke on it, and start to cough. He says nothing but simply waits me out. He recognizes a delaying tactic when he sees one, damn it. I have a problem with the violin. He nods encouragement. I laugh shakily. Bob is convinced it wants to eat him. Armstrong looks understanding.
Yes, I can understand that.
I shiver. Bob and I are living apart. Well, we sort things out. There have been incidents, problems. You know he's the eater of souls now. The violin and the hungry ghost do not see eye to eye. A pause. Then, I understand. He speaks in the distant, respectful tones of an undertaker. Emma McDougall sent me a brilliantly qualified deputy director. On paper, she's absolutely the best possible pick. Management fast track, MBA, extremely ambitious and motivated. A real self-starter. Only she's Mary Murphy.
Do you have a problem with Miss Murphy?
Armstrong asks sympathetically. She's Bob's ex. And she's a fang. And the last time we met before she was assigned to me, she was sleeping in my living room. Bob had invited her. It was the night of the Code Red, and he said she needed a safe house to stay where nobody would think to look for her, and we... I swallow. Lecter tried to murder her.
Lecter?
He raises an eyebrow.
Also known as Dracula.
I nod.
Well then, I can see why you might have a problem, he says soothingly. But she's still on your organisation chart.
Have you... No, I swallow. As I said, she's superbly suited for the job. It'd be a disaster to lose her over something so stupid. So we came to a working agreement. I don't know if it'll hold. I take another sip of whiskey. I trust her as far as I can throw her. She's a vampire, and an ambitious bitch besides, and I still get panic attacks when she comes up behind me. But she's scared of me too. Or she's scared of Lecter. Balance of terror in the boardroom. What an innovative and ingenious way to run a department. Caught to keep the directors on their toes. I stop, because I'm babbling again.
Aside from Ms. Murphy, who, as you know, is superbly qualified for the job, do you have any other problems?
He asks.
Yes.
Emma sent me a personnel manager who shouldn't even be in the organisation at all. Do you know the background to Jennifer Morgue? He nods. Blue Hades have come over all helpful. 2 weeks ago, at the Treaty Birds of a Feather, I ran into Ramona Random. Purely at random, of course, except it wasn't. And you can't convince me it's any kind of accident that they sent her to us as a liaison body and HR sent her to me to babysit. Tell me, what kind of circus are we running that a rival firm can inject a known operative into our organisation and we're expected to babysit them? It's worse than crazy. It's against OPSEC doctrine.
Hell, it's a photographic negative of OPSEC doctrine.
I realise my voice has risen to a shrill whine when he winces, and I shut it down quick.
Well, that's a very interesting coincidence indeed, he says knowingly,
which is when I realise I've been set up.
Is there anything else you want me to know about?
I roll my eyes. What, like a certain chief superintendent of police who works for the Association of Chief Police Officers who just happens to be clear to work with us? And who, in another life, just happens to also be a Four Sigma superhero, officer friendly? And who just happened to turn up in time for the Freudstein debacle at the library a couple of days ago, and who is due to turn up in my office tomorrow to discuss how he's going to run the official government superhero team for me? And speaking of Freudstein, did you know he's been stealing violin scores?
That all sounds extremely interesting,
the SE says brightly. I take another sip of whiskey as he continues.
What a fascinating barrage of coincidences. It must be amazingly convenient for you to have such a high-powered team to work with.
I cough whiskey halfway across the room.
Are you kidding?
I croak.
Not at all,
he smiles beatifically.
I see you're off to a flying start.
I put my empty tumbler down on the edge of his desk, hoping he won't move to refill it.
What? Dr. O'Brien.
He leans back and rests one ankle atop the other. Your brief is to operate the official government superhero team.
Yes.
So, look at it from our point of view.
He takes another sip of whiskey and looks contemplative.
In the next few days, you'll receive confirmation that your funding is in the pipeline, and the Home Sec has approved your Phase 1 mission goals. Your next job will be to recruit and train a team of superpowers, 3 or 4 Sigma superheroes to be precise. Volunteers who have the right attitude. Supporters of law and order. Which, in this context, means you're going to be overrun by Daily Mail readers who can hurl lightning bolts and grow tentacles.
Wait. I must look horrified, because he gives an avuncular little chuckle as he twinkles at me.
What sort of fool goes out and buys a Lycra body stocking and cape, then beats up on bank robbers for their jollies? They're not like you and I. Normal for Norfolk, maybe, but not likely to pass our background checks and personality profiling under regular conditions. There are also going to be 3 or 4 Sigma types who are already visible to the public. A certain level of narcissistic personality disorder goes with the territory, as does a predisposition towards authoritarianism and a naive belief in playing cops and robbers. Charming people. So we need someone to keep them in line, and that someone is you.
Oh, hell. I'm doomed. Utterly doomed.
His logic is completely unassailably right. We're going to be inundated with numbskulls who have acquired the power to vent their existential rage on a complex multicultural society that they don't understand.
We're going to end up with UKIP in a pervert suit.
But we're going to have to comply with gender, ethnicity, and disability non-discrimination law. He shakes his head.
I'm sorry, but the official Home Office superhero team is going to have to conform to public expectations of what a superhero team should look like, or it's not really going to work terribly well. There's room for one person of colour, one female or LGBT, and one disability in a core team of 4. If you push it beyond that ratio, it'll lose credibility with the crucial 16 to 24 male target demographic by deviating too far from their expectations. Remember, reasonable people who acquire superpowers are not our target. This is a propaganda operation aimed at the unreasonable ones. Disturbed hero-worshipping nerd bigots who, if they accidentally acquire superpowers, will go on a marked wrecked spree, unless they're held in check by firm guidance and a role model to channel them in less destructive directions.
But, you're telling me I'm going to be managing a team of 4 Sigma assholes and capes? How am I supposed to keep them in line?
The SA smiles again, and now I realize that he's taking delight in my dismay.
That's impossible.
No, it isn't, Dr. O'Brien.
He sits up and leans towards me, confidingly.
You see, I was the one who instructed Emma to send you the people you're talking about.
You... what?
For the real Home Office superhero team, Dr. O'Brien, the management superhero team. The ones who will stay discreetly in the background and organise the paperwork and the logistics and do all the heavy lifting. While the incorrigibles arrest supervillains and take credit for everything and preen in front of the television cameras. For the real team, who will yank the incorrigibles' choke chain if they get out of hand. The team I've very carefully spent the past month recruiting and assembling for you.
He begins raising fingers.
First, the Met offered us the use of Officer Friendly, who, as a 4 Sigma superhero in his own right, also happens to be one of the 3 highest-ranking police officers cleared for laundry liaison operations. Abilities? Super strength, flight, night vision, powers of arrest and paperwork, and a master's degree in criminal psychology. We'd be idiots to turn him down, even if they think he's there to keep his line managers fully informed of our activities. He's a perfect fit for the team.
Secondly, I asked Blue Hades if we could borrow Ramona Random. She's a retired occult clandestine operations officer and a highly experienced intelligence analyst. She can operate underwater, in which environment she has unparalleled flexibility. You might also have noticed that she is able to project an extremely powerful glamour. She's a rather powerful necromancer as well, thanks to a not dissimilar entanglement process to the one that gifted your husband with the powers of the Eater of Souls. Oh, and Blue Hades kindly agreed to loan us and train her in operating a rather interesting piece of high technology equipment that will come in handy when you need to move the team around. Think of her as your science backup. He pauses to pick up the bottle of scotch and tips a finger into my glass. Thirdly, we come to Ms. Mary Murphy, who needs no introduction except to say she's a fang, a person of hemophagous, anagathic neurodegeneracy, otherwise known as a vampire, complete with super strength, mind control, inability to see herself in mirrors, and a tendency to catch fire in sunlight. The usual, in other words. Yes, she's a blood-sucking fiend, but she's also a superbly competent administrator and has an MBA, which I think you'll agree makes up for a lot of sins. Speaking of which, you do remember that she and your husband were over practically before you met him. High-level managers often have to work with highly competent officers who they do not like, but do so in a professional and even-handed manner. Think of it as a test of your resilience, if you want. And finally, there's you, Doctor. Combat epistemologist, lecturer in paradimensional harmonic summonings, highly competent magus, and entangled with, bearer of, the pale violin. I watch, horrified, as he reaches for the decanter once more. Together, he declares, as he wraps my nerveless fingers around the refilled tumbler. You will fight crime. It is only on my way back to my desk after lunch, the AC insists on taking me to his club for a celebratory meal, that I realize I never got to discuss the vexatious Professor Freudstein and his curious musicological obsession with him. When I finally get back to my office, I am rattled to find Officer Friendly cooling his heels in the lobby, just as Dr. Armstrong promised. He's in mufti, wearing a suit, not a police uniform, but everything about him screams cop. I manage to fake a smile, even though my stomach is leaden and acid indigestion threatens. Good afternoon, Chief Superintendent. Are you a Jim or a James? He rises. Jim is fine, he purrs. We shake hands. His grip is reassuringly solid. I gather you've been in a meeting with the, senior auditor. Dr. Armstrong, yes. He told me to expect you. I hold up a finger. Let's talk in my office. Office furniture conveys relative status. I park myself on my throne, and Jim responds adroitly by moving his seat off to one side so the desk isn't between us. My grand boss put him in touch with me a month ago, he says, sounding utterly unapologetic. He told me not to tip you the wink prematurely. Jesus, how high up does this go? Well, welcome aboard. I guess you're our official police liaison, coming at this from the SS side of the table, I shrug. Where are you desking on the police side? In a porter cabin in the car park round the back of Belgravia Nick. He looks crestfallen. We're ridiculously short on office space in central London these days, since they sold the old yard off because they thought that moving everybody over to hot desking and smartphones would save floor space. On the other hand, all I need on that side is an analyst and a pair of bodies to handle contacts and paperwork until we've got a team ready to deploy. About which? He glances at the doorway expectantly. Yes, that. Wait one. I pick up my phone and make a couple of brief calls. By the time I put the handset down, the first invitee is slipping in the door. Mary, I'd like you to meet Chief Superintendent Jim Gray from the Met. Jim is on secondment to ACPO, and he's going to be our point of contact with the police. You've already met his alter ego. How do you do? Mary shakes hands with Jim and peers into his eyes. They both flinch.
Ouch!
Charmed.
Jim smiles thinly. Mary frowns and tucks her gloved hand behind her.
Pleased to meet you too,
she says darkly. I try to make sense of this as the door opens and Ramona wheels in.
Gang's all here, I announce.
Jim, this is Ramona. More introductions. This time nobody tries for a psychic beatdown. If you'd like to grab chairs and gather round.
Yes, well, what's...
Mary's eyes slide towards Jim.
This all about?
We've been set up, I announce cheerily. The culprit confessed, which is the good news.
What kind of setup?
Mary's eyes narrow.
A logical one.
I nod at Officer Friendly. Jim is the final corner of our tent. It's all Dr. Armstrong's fault. He decided to assemble a team without telling its prospective members, which is why I've been looking over my shoulder this whole time. I'm supposed to set strategy. Mary, you're on execution of policy. Ramona, you're in charge of human resources and logistics. And Jim, you're here for liaison and forward intelligence. It was absolutely a setup, but our puppet master believes in giving his proxies enough free will to tangle up their own strings.
Oh, hell!
Mary begins, just as Jim tries to say something.
What?
It's Thursday afternoon, I tell them. So the SA tells me that next Monday HR are going to send round our third wave of recruits. We've got tomorrow to read resumes and filter out the obvious no-hopers. Next week we get to interview the survivors. Our job is to pick four of them and mould them into a public superhero team, complete with uniforms, origin stories, the whole Marvel DC public relations package. I glance round the room. Sort of like us, actually. Only younger, more photogenic, and willing to get beaten up by supervillains on BBC News 24. We just have to handle the paperwork and run the office. Nothing, really. That gets a chuckle. Except from Jim, who has presumably spent so many years collaring miscreants that the joke's worn thin.
Great, says Ramona. That explains the rumbling from HR about a pile of CVs they're going to drop on us this evening.
Can you all clear tomorrow afternoon from your calendars so we can go over them together? I ask.
I've got a meeting at 2 with my divisional commander, says Jim. It's to sign off on the resources I need for this project, so it really can't wait.
But can you be over here by 5? I ask. He hesitates for a moment, then nods.
Great.
Well then, the rest of us will get stuck in beforehand.
And then, well, I was thinking about adjourning for a team-building exercise at 7.
What do you have in mind?
Asks Mary.
Any cuisine we all like, as long as it doesn't include calamari.
I keep an eye on Ramona, but she doesn't even twitch.
I know a decent trattoria that's not far away, Jim volunteers. Want me to make a reservation?
That would be great. I stand. I should have laid in some bubbly for this, shouldn't I?
Anyway, here's to teamwork.
And for some reason, they all stand, and we end up in some kind of four-way handshake. And for a moment, I have a very odd feeling that an invisible caped figure, larger than any of us, is looming over all our shoulders and nodding its approval.